It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
Hi, and thank you for joining us this evening. You're listening to WABC Mind Your Business. I'm Jessica Proud, filling in for Yitzhak Saflis. Tonight, we have a very interesting guest with us, Paul Kurtman, who is here to talk about payday lending. Now, this is not something I really knew too much about, but there's an important change coming down from the feds. And Paul's here to talk to us about that and what kind of impact it will have. Paul, thanks so much for being with us today. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and explain to listeners exactly what a payday loan is.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Jessica. As you just introduced me to the guest, my name is Paul Kurtman. I'm a state representative from Missouri. I've been in office now for about 6 years. Before that, I served in the United States Marine Corps between active duty and reserves for a total of about 10 years. I also work in the financial services industry. A payday loan is essentially these things that you see on television. You see them on the street corners in different communities where people can go into a little building, a little shop, and they can get an emergency loan. They can get a short-term loan. They can have their pay advance from this company. But then whenever they pay back the money, they usually have to pay it back at a higher rate of interest. So there are people who are upset with these companies, and they call them predatory lenders, and they refer to predatory lending practices. And the reason they're upset is because a lot of people go to get these loans and they can't pay them back. And as the terms of the loan would dictate, the longer they go without paying the loan back, the higher the interest rate might go until before too long, people find themselves in what's commonly called a debt trap. And the loan is too much that they just can't get out from underneath it under their current personal financial circumstances. So the federal government, under Barack Obama's, President Obama's administration, has created a brand new bureaucracy called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And this sounds like it's a great idea. It sounds like they're really looking out for consumers. But the problem is they're writing thousands and thousands of pages worth of brand new laws. And these laws are telling payday lenders who they can and can't do business with. So the unintended consequence that I think is going to happen here is there's going to be a lot of people who can't get a loan anywhere else. They won't be able to get it from a traditional bank because banks don't make short-term, high-risk loans. And so as people don't go to the banks and then they find out that they now can't even go to a payday lender because the government has written rules saying that payday lenders can't give these other people loans, my concern is that people are going to wind up turning to illegal markets to get loans, loan sharks. Places where there is no justice, there is no transparency, no accountability, no oversight. And I think this is just another case of the federal government stepping in and writing brand new laws outside of the jurisdiction or purview of Congress that's going to have some negative consequences on our economy and the people that actually need this market from time to time.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the classic, scary phrase that you hear, we're the government and we're here to help, and it winds up having unintended consequences. I mean, to me, this strikes me a lot as something that will have a particular impact in low-income communities that, that don't have credit or don't have access. You know, many people, especially in the larger debate that you have in urban areas about immigrant communities, people that come here, a lot of them don't even have bank accounts set up yet. So let alone credit history. So what are these people supposed to do that need access to funding?
And that's the question that the bureaucrats can't answer. And they refuse to even try to answer because they know what the answer is. They know that they're not actually doing anything to help people that might find themselves in a position where they need a short-term loan. My first experience with this was several years ago when I was in the Marine Corps. I went to a bank, and I didn't know any. I've never had needed a loan before, so I went to a bank and I said, "I just need $200. I need to buy a plane ticket so I can go home for family event that was coming up, and the bank said, sorry, we don't offer short-term high-risk loans. We don't offer short-term loans of such small amounts. But then I was referred to a payday lender just down the street. Well, since then, the government has introduced laws and regulations that affect military differently, but still, under those same circumstances, under these brand new rules, it's very likely that even when I went to the payday lender down the street, the payday lender would have to say, sorry, we can't give you a $200 loan to fly home because the federal government told us that you're somebody who might get caught in a debt trap. The problem here is that whenever the government begins to exercise this economic intervention, they quite literally begin to make the decisions for consumers and producers, and they lock a lot of people out of the market that actually need access to these services.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, you're really taking money out of the economy, essentially. And a lot of people, you know, if they get paid bi-weekly or monthly, you know, they mm-hmm. might need that week or two holdover to get to the paycheck. And they might not have a credit card or access to that cash flow. It doesn't mean that they can't make good on their debts, I would think. I mean, if you're a free market capitalist, I think you would support a product that the market indicates there's a demand for. But is this really a party line issue, or, you know, what are people in Congress saying about this?
You see, and this is where a huge problem is. There's no way to tell whether or not this is a party line issue. There's not even a way to tell whether or not this is a law that reflects the will of the people, right? Because if you look in the United States Constitution, the very first binding words of the Constitution say all legislative power is vested in Congress. So anytime there's any types of laws being passed, it's supposed to be done through the people's representation. But what we have now, and this is exactly what I told the Bureau when I had an opportunity to testify in June in Kansas City, when you have bureaucrats that begin to write brand new laws, and then they also execute the laws, and then they also adjudicate the laws, then at that point, you have a bureaucracy that's run by unelected, unaccountable people, and they have now encompassed all three branches of our government, and they've effectively robbed people of their representative form of government. So whenever you have laws like this, these are laws that are not representative of our people. And the problem here is this is one of the things that frustrates me about Congress. I know there's a movement now in Congress to kind of start taking their power back. But now when you have mm-hmm. bureaucrats that write laws like this, the way Congress has all too often, unfortunately, responded is they just have a hearing to talk about the laws that bureaucrats wrote. And it's just backwards and upside down. And then the longer we continue down this road of government by bureaucracy, the more holes we're going to dig for our people, especially the poorest people among us who need access to services like this. Sure, I'm certainly not defending all the payday lending practices, because certainly people do abuse, like in any business, in any form or aspect of life, there are people that are a little bit abusive and, you know, fraudulent. But still, allowing the free markets to work so the poorest people among us at least still have some choices regarding their own economy and their own economic direction is something that needs to be left up to our people and our representation, not a bureaucracy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, sadly, this is frankly becoming a bit of a hallmark of the Obama administration. You're seeing it in basically every area of agencies, whether it's, you know, the EPA or HUD or the Business Administration, the regulations, it's really becoming a massive bureaucratic growth that is putting pressure on a lot of small businesses. What can people do to stop it? Is there anything that they can do to put pressure on Congress to try to weigh in? Do you think it's able to be stopped before this rule goes into effect?
Yeah, I really think that people need to get a hold of their congressmen and their senators. And there comes a certain point in time where you just almost need to shame your elected representation into not actually guarding the power that they're supposed to have. And this is a clear case of Congress allowing a bureaucracy to run away with congressional authority. And so I think that people have got to get a hold of their congressman, they have to get a hold of their senator and tell them, and even if this is not their issue, even if payday lending isn't necessarily an issue that concerns them, the issue that should concern them is the fact that we have bureaucracy totally running away with lawmaking authority in our nation, and it's robbing our people of their own representation. Here in Missouri, we've had the Department of Labor write a rule saying that family farms, that your own children can't work on your own family farm. It's just crazy the kind of stuff that bureaucrats are doing. And to also respond to your earlier question, when bureaucrats are confronted with these questions, you know, well, what do you do for these people then if they can't work on their farm or if they can't get a loan? They don't have the answers. This is all just political, and people have got to get a hold of the congressmen and the senators to make this come to a swift and decisive end.
Yeah, no, and I would also think, I mean, look, there's a lot of issues that are very prescient right now going on in the national debate, but this could be a fun question for the presidential candidates to find out where they stand on the issue. You know, you have Hillary Clinton on one hand making a big piece of her campaign about helping those disaffected Americans that are in low-income communities and inner cities. And then on the flip side, you have Donald Trump talking a lot about these massive overregulations that are, mm-hmm. You know, the growth of the federal government. So I would be interested to hear what they would have to say about that. And alternatively, if you're opposed to it, what the solution is.
Yeah, hey, that would be a great question to see in a debate. The way we've seen some of these debates go, sometimes we get a lot more fluff and nonsense than we do actual issues that quite literally on a daily basis affects people in our communities across America. And certainly mm-hmm. this is one of those issues that affects people on a daily basis. When I was in the military, and like I said, the rules have been written differently, laws have been passed, so it's different with between the military personnel and everybody else at this point. But the fact remains that when you have a bunch of privates in the military, they don't make a lot of money. So they often find themselves in a position where they're constantly having to go to these payday lenders to try to get access to cash that they don't currently have. And certainly that there are people that are living below the poverty line or maybe just above the poverty line, or they're living on shoestring budgets. And from time to time, they might need access to this. But the government and Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren and this particular bureau has advocated the writing of laws to lock the poorest people and the most vulnerable people out of that whole market. And it's a moral transgression against the American people for bureaucrats to be doing that.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think the more effective approach would be? I mean, you did say occasionally, of course, there's going to be a couple of bad apples in mm-hmm. every industry. Wouldn't it make more sense to try to enforce and make sure that people aren't being taken advantage of, or maybe have, you know, some fines or penalties on people that do take advantage and commit wrongdoing? Wouldn't that be more effective than blowing up the whole market and taking away this valuable tool for people?
Yeah, listen, there is a number of ways that we can handle bad actors in this industry or any industry without actually regulating both producers and consumers in the marketplace. For example, I mean, just free market economics, which a lot of people like to, you know, disparage in debates. In fact, when I actually addressed this issue with the director of the bureau, Director Cordray, and his response to me, he actually got angry with me when I testified in Memphis, and he said, "We're not just going to let this industry go unregulated. It's a total lack of regulation that led to the financial crisis of 2008. People like you just want the wild, wild west." And I wish I would have had time, and I wish I could actually debate him on this. Because the fact of the matter is that government intervention in the marketplace, telling people what they can and can't do with their own money, is actually precisely what led to the financial crisis. The Community Reinvestment Act, that told banks you have to loosen your lending practices and actually give money to people who probably you wouldn't be interested in lending money to because you know it's a high-risk loan. That helped drastically, substantially encourage the problem that led to the housing bubble. So it's government intervention that is the wild, wild west, because government intervention and bureaucrats are the gunslingers out to shoot everybody else down. Through their own decision making of who gets to live and who gets to die in the marketplace. So free market economics, the bad actors will take care of themselves. And then on top of that, we have a justice system. So if there is fraud, if there is waste, if there is abuse, the justice system, that's what it's there for. That's how we take care of problems.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, you look at Dodd-Frank, and I don't know if this was, you know, a piece of that spawned this growth, but, they ended up doing more harm than good. And you hear a lot of experts say that the financial system is not any safer. The banks aren't any more secure. So, do you think we should just roll back Dodd-Frank altogether, or, you know, was this part of that?
The Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, was part of Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank led to this. That when you talk about Dodd-Frank and how much good it is or isn't doing, it really hasn't done a lot to address the justice of people that were bad actors that led to the financial crisis. And if you look at the most recent case of Wells Fargo creating fake accounts so that way they could charge and gouge their clients for more fees. It was a racket. And certainly all the regulation that our government tried to apply certainly didn't do anything to prevent that from happening. However, what's interesting is now that they've been caught, they're actually, you know, we're allowing our justice system to work and find remedy for this. So certainly when you do have bad actors, you don't need regulation to stop everybody, but you can have a solid, fair, and equitable justice system that will substantially go a long way to preventing people from committing fraud or abuse in the future in any other industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know, how many people do you think take advantage of payday lending? Is it something that you've seen?
Nationwide? Consumers?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's nationwide and often in the more lower income or even poverty-stricken areas because, like I said, it's those people that find themselves in a position where they need access to cash more routinely that they don't get through their normal income. So all across our nation, you will see these companies on street corners. You will see them in neighborhoods where people are more likely to be in need of small amounts of cash. All across America.
How do you have any estimation on what the annual amount of money being borrowed is?
That's a good question. I don't have that. I don't have that information.
I'm just curious because you think a lot these people that are using the money, they're using it to buy groceries. Maybe they're using it to buy clothes for their kids. I mean, this is all money that is also being sucked back out of the economy. And, maybe they're using it to pay their bills and, obviously going to put people in a deeper financial trap, maybe be evicted from their homes or their apartments.
And I think what it might wind up doing is just going to make, instead of having people affording them the freedom, the economic freedom to be able to make their own decisions with their money or whether or not they want to risk, taking a loan. If they're locked out of the market, what is going to happen here, one of two things, people are going to find illegal means of borrowing money where there's going to be no justice involved, mm-hmm. or else they're just going to become immediately dependent on the government, even deeper than they might already be. Both of which I think are just travesties to put our people in that situation by just robbing them of their own economic freedom.
So do you think it would make sense to just, gut the CFPB Bureau and let the states handle this rather than...
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, the Constitution, that's the remedy that the Constitution prescribes. People should not have to be going to Washington, D.C. If they feel like the guy that lent them $200 last week is gouging them. You're supposed to be able to handle it in your state, in your local level. That's exactly what the Constitution has set up in Article 1, Section 8, 9, 10, and the 9th and 10th Amendments. But everything's kind of been turned upside down where the government's supposed to be the answers to all of our, questions about what's right and wrong in America today.
Yeah, well, it certainly is, a very important topic. And I think, the fact that the economy continues to struggle, people are still unemployed or they're underemployed, they're wages have been stagnant for, over a decade, 15, 16 years, that, you know, that is part of the problem. And I think that, you know, this is something that Congress should address, or at least, you know, have them speak out and try to stop it. And, you know, hopefully the next president will take this issue up. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with viewers today, Paul?
Yeah, it's all throughout world history, one reoccurring maxim from one nation to the next, from one century to the next, is this: economic prosperity follows the path of least resistance. So if people want to have economic prosperity, what we definitely have to have is a government that stays out of people's economic choices and is just there to execute justice and a little bit of oversight from time to time. But economic prosperity follows the path of least resistance.
Well, that was well said, and I will leave it at that. Again, thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. You're listening to WABC, Mind Your Business. I'm Jessica Proud, filling in. We had Paul Kirtman today. Paul, thank you so much. That was very informative and something that, you know, people should really be aware of and contact their representatives about. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
Best Payroll delivers the affordable payroll solutions you need so that you could focus on your business. Today's payroll laws are complicated and constantly changing. Why should you have to worry about keeping yourself up to date with these details when you can rely on Best Payroll's fully bonded tax service to take care of it for you? Best Payroll has been managing the payroll needs of small to mid-sized companies across the country since 1989. Their experienced and dedicated professionals are committed to providing you with cost-effective payroll management solutions. Why spend your time, money, and effort handling your business's payroll when you could rely on Best Payroll to get the job done right at a price you can't beat? To learn more what Best Payroll can do for your company, dial 347-729-2355. That's 347-729-2355. Or visit bestpayroll.net. That's bestpayroll.net. Best Payroll, the experienced payroll professionals.
Your company website is crucial to your success, providing information about your company to the entire world. Was your website recently updated? Is it mobile friendly? And does it have the 2016 look? Well, look no further than WebsiteWithBrains.com, the complete website solution. Call Website with Brains today at 718-412-3500. That's 718-412-3500. Or visit WebsiteWithBrains.com. The experienced team at Website with Brains will plan, write, design, and program a stunning and informative website that combines simplicity and flexibility. Best of all, Website with Brains can have your new website up and running within 4 to 6 weeks. Get ready to look great online and take your business to the next level. See some of the attractive, user-friendly sites built by Website with Brains by visiting WebsiteWithBrains.com. Then give Website with Brains a call at 718-412-3500. That's 718-412-3500.
Welcome back to Mind Your Business, the weekly radio show for business and marketing insights, every Sunday from 11 to midnight on 77 WABC Radio. I'm Bill O'Reilly. You've been listening to my business partner, Jessica Proud. We're from the November team, and we're guest hosting tonight for Yitzhak Saklis, the marketing genius of Bottom Line Marketing. And he's off for the holidays. We'll be back next week. I've got to just mention one thing in advance, and Yitzhak would be embarrassed if I was doing it, but he's got such a wonderful book that I give to clients, I give to friends. It's called So What's the Bottom Line? It's 76 tips for, you know, marketing tips for business. And they're so easy to understand. Even I get them. And the announcement is that it's now available on Kindle for those of you who read Kindle. I'm a big Kindle fan. You can get it on Amazon. So What's the Bottom Line? Yitzhak Saklis. We have a terrific guest to talk the whole helicopter ride for business climate. Her name is Julie Killian. She's a city councilwoman in Westchester County and running for state senate. And I love Julie right away because I've known Julie for a long time. We work together. Julie has a degree in chemical engineering from Notre Dame, where a lot of my relatives went. And she has a master's in finance from NYU, where I went. So I instantly like Julie the moment we met. Julie, welcome to Mind Your Business.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be on.
Yeah, thank you. You know, the business recently, the business climate index came out again for how states rank in business friendliness across the country. And yet again, New York, this time was 49th. It goes back and forth between 49th and 50th. But the message is, seems to be clear to businesses. You're not welcome here. It's a tough place to do business. You're running for state senate, Julie, in Westchester. How does Julie Killian fix it? What are the problems in New York that make doing business here tough?
Well, let me just start by saying there's a lot of reasons I'm running, and this is one of the big ones. And the reason the business climate is so important is that it's the thing, when you have a vibrant economy, when there's jobs, when people are happy to be moving here, kids graduating from college are happy to come back home and work, and they can afford to do it, you just have a more vibrant economy, and that lets you do all the other things that we're all so passionate about, you know, protecting the environment, helping those in need, funding the arts, because those are all the things that get cut first when things are bad. So those things are all very important to me, but I truly believe that having a better and vibrant economy, both in Westchester, New York City, and New York State, is the key to all of that.
I think that's such a good point, Julie Killian, because, right, you can't pay for the infrastructure repairs, you can't pay for the music classes, you can't pay for the sports teams if you just tax the state to death. I think that's a really good point, that if you care about, if you're somebody who believes in and wants government programs, you gotta have the business backing it up. Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And sadly, in New York State, we make it hard for people to do business. And they do things like tinkering on the edges. They had a public referendum allowing more casinos in, and we have something called Startup New York, which gives tax incentives to businesses that are moving New York. It's been an utter failure. And really what we need to do is stop picking winners and losers. Give everybody a tax break. Let's help the businesses that are already here. Why are we crushing them? We're crushing them with regulation. It's insane, Bill. It's insane. It has to stop. That's one of the reasons I'm running for office.
Yeah, on the startup thing, I the news broke recently. I think the state controller, the Democratic state controller, Tom DiNapoli, issued a report on startup, and it was just crazy. And I think the state had spent $53 million in advertising, saying how great New York was for business, and only brought in 409 jobs, I think was the number. And I think the total cost of the program was like, you know, $250 million. It was like $240 million or something for 409 jobs.
It makes me crazy to think about the money, that money that could have been so much better spent. It makes me crazy. And we just, again, need to stop picking winners and losers and make it just a good place to do business where people want to stay. You know, New York has the largest domestic out-migration of any state. So our population has actually increased, but we have the most people leaving, the most taxpayers leaving, and the most businesses leaving. And they're going to places like Florida and Texas. Florida just got rid of 4,000 business regulations. I have two friends that just moved to Florida. They're not 75. They're 50, yeah. And they're moving to Florida. And they're running their businesses there. And, you know, they all talk to their employees, and they all collectively decided, okay, we're up for it. That's what we have to stop. And, you know, I so often it's the states in the South that people are moving to, but there's states in the Midwest. Indiana's doing incredibly well. They've made it a much more business-friendly state. And I went to college in Indiana, as you said, 4 years in Indiana. I felt like in the winters it snowed almost every day. There was a little bit of snow almost every day. I loved it, but it's cold there. But they're doing well, so it's not just about the climate. People will stay here. People want to stay here. I mean, I do on occasion meet people that have moved back here because their grandchildren are here. They want to stay here. They want to be with their grandkids. They want to be with their kids. Almost everybody I talk to loves New York, and they're devastated to leave. But I've been walking neighborhoods and going to events for 6 months now and talking to small businesses, and I keep hearing the same thing. I'm putting my house on the market. I can't afford it anymore. Just talking to a man in Mount Vernon who has a business. It's a manufacturing business. He has 100 employees. He said, we've decided no more. 100 employees, we're not going above that. He said, and I just invested in a business that does automation that will partially help his business, but he just thinks that's the future. And that's I think automation is our future, but the harder we make the more we make it expensive to do business here, the more people are looking for options like that, whether they're moving, going to automation, which we've got, you know, we've got to do it. We've got to keep up with technology. But, you know, certainly it's decreasing the number of jobs.
Yeah, we're talking to Julie Killian, who's a state Senate candidate in Westchester County. Julie, could you just let the listeners know which lines you're running on? This is a November 8th election, is that right? Is this just general election? Which lines are you running
8th.
On?
I'm running on the Republican, Conservative, Independent, and Reform Party lines.
Right.
So I'm very proud to have all of those.
Yeah, the Reform Party line, I know because we work together, is something you're especially proud of, because I know term limits in Albany is one of your major plans, getting term limits up there. Why do you think term limits are, I mean, I agree with you, but for other listeners, why should term limits be so important in New York State, in the state government?
Well, for two reasons. One is we've had so much corruption in New York, which is also what makes business more expensive. We've had so much corruption just this past year, head of the New York State Senate arrested, convicted. Head of the New York State Assembly arrested, convicted. 39 legislators.
Yeah, one Republican, one Democrat, right.
Yeah, it's bipartisan corruption, and it has to stop. And so with term limits, we will just keep new ideas and new people coming through to Albany. Now, so I said two things. One is the corruption. The second is just the fresh ideas and new perspectives. I don't understand how the rankings that we've had, and, you know, we're last in business climate, worst place to retire, largest out-migration, how it's not a wake-up call to the leaders of our state. Somehow
highest property taxes in the country.
Highest property taxes. They think that if we're just a little better than, like, Connecticut and New Jersey, that that's okay. I just reject that out of hand. I think New York is the greatest state in the country. I think that we survive here despite the bad economic policies. Certainly, there's so many things that are vibrant about New York City. And we've seen it. I've lived in New York City that was not so good back in the 80s and certainly the 70s when I was a teenager. We could go in that direction. And I want to stop our state from doing that. But the term limits, it's just getting fresh ideas and a new way of looking at things, because they get so caught up in the status quo that some of the things that go on, they don't even realize are problems. And a woman, I had a lovely coffee in Bronxville, New York, with 30 women this morning, and one woman said to me she had moved from California. She couldn't believe how hard it was just when you're purchasing real estate and all the things you had to go through and all the papers and all the fees. She said, it's so easy in California. It's so hard here. We don't even know any better. That's just normal for us.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when my wife and I bought a house, we did not see the closing costs coming with all the fees and taxes that New York hits you with. I mean, it was a lot of money. And, you know, one of the New York fees was what we had budgeted for new furniture. And it was like, whoa, you know. You said, Julie Killian, you said something very interesting a few minutes ago. You talked about corruption's impact on business in New York and presumably also on individuals as taxpayers. Could you talk to that? Because I'm not sure people automatically make that correlation. They see corruption and they say, okay, that guy, that guy's a crook and he tried to, take a kickback here and they slapped the cuffs on him. But how does that affect real people and businesses, in your opinion?
I mean, essentially, it's like a corruption tax. And when people are paying bribes and when it makes it more expensive for those business to do business, all they do is turn around and pass it on to the taxpayer. Or if it's a municipality somehow involved with something like that, they just turn around and pass it on to the taxpayers. And it's just it's like a never ending circle. And it's just sort of the incumbent politicians, the career politicians, the political class, the political hacks, as I sometimes call them, it's like they all feed off the system, which is why it's so difficult to change. And that's why we need to keep having people come through and have I truly believe in citizen legislators. I believe that's what our founding fathers intended, and I still believe that. I view myself as a citizen, as a public servant. I've been on city council for 4.5 years. I do not get paid. It is totally volunteer. But I view myself as a public servant and a citizen legislator, and that's what I think we need to encourage in New York. We don't have enough of those. We have way too many career politicians.
Yeah, I would say just as somebody who's been around and has worked in New York politics for a good chunk of time, it's almost the legal corruption that is worse or more expensive. The things you don't see, you have the special interest is an overused term, but when you have the people, the interest groups that are reelecting essentially these incumbents through donations, through phone banks, they have the organizational structure built, year round. Yeah. And then the electeds are passing legislation that benefits them. I mean, who pays for that?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll just, one of the big, and this is a big issue across the country, occupational licensing, where, different occupations lobby our legislators, and they're already in the business, and they make it harder for new people to get in. And I'll give you an example. To be a barber in New York, 882 days of training, and you have 3 exams. To be a security guard in New York, 35 days of training, no exams. You are safer in your barber's chair than you are with any security guard. I mean, is that insane?
And you wonder how that law got written.
You want to open you want to become a barber? Well, 882 days of training. They're more on top of the ladies doing your nails at the nail salon than they are on our security guards. It's really crazy. And there's the legal corruption, and then just the other thing that people don't think about with the regulation, the corruption, and it isn't just the time and the money squandered on compliance, but it's all the forfeited opportunities. The company's never launched, the technology's never invented, the job's never created, and the products consumers will never see. Part of the problem.
I talked to somebody who is a job relocator about a year ago. And I said, his business is to identify places where other businesses could relocate. And he said that New York is not even on the list. It's not even on the radar anymore.
Are you kidding?
That it's the states that you mentioned. Right, exactly. Like, it's Florida, it's Texas, it's South Carolina, it's, North Dakota. Some people say, like you mentioned before, Julie, you said that, that it's not just the warm weather states that a lot of people like to say. I mean, North Dakota was booming when New York was atrophying.
Yeah, and South Dakota was actually just named in the 2016 State Business Tax Climate Index. They were second in the best. Wyoming was the first, South Dakota the best, Alaska third. None of those are warm weather states. Florida was fourth. Yeah. So it's kind of a false argument they use, like, oh, well, people want to go to the warm weather and then just staying just ahead of New Jersey and Connecticut. I'll say it again. I think New York is one of the greatest states in the union. There's so much more that can be done here. And it's sad, though. Some of the solutions are really easy. New York has all kinds of antiquated laws that have been around.
Yeah, hit me with them. I'd love to hear it. Yep.
We could get rid of in a flash. We have something called the scaffold law in New York. It's been around since the 1800s. It's related to anything that happens with gravity on construction sites. There's absolute liability with the owner of the site and with the contractor. So, for example, if a worker shows up to work drunk and climbs a ladder and falls down and hurts himself, he is not responsible at all. It is solely the problem of the owner of the site and the construction company that employs him. So there's absolute liability with them. So the interesting thing is Illinois got rid of this law. They were the second to last state to have it. They got rid of it about 5 years ago. Their construction accidents went down when they got rid of it. So it is estimated to cost New Yorkers $1.4 billion, and yes, I said $1 billion a year, just because we have this law on the books.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So I was going to say, we're now building the Tappan Zee Bridge. They estimate that just because the scaffold law exists, it costs New York State taxpayers $200 to $400 million more for the Tappan Zee Bridge. And that is one of the reasons we have less insurance choices in New York, because there's people that just want insurance in New York.
I was just going to raise that
that point. We're talking to Julie Killian, who's a state Senate candidate in Westchester, who we're talking about the impact of bad government policy in New York on business and on families. The bottom line is people fleeing the state because of the taxes and the lack of good jobs. But Julie, I had a client a bunch of years ago who wanted to get some they wanted to go after insurance fraud in the auto industry in New York State, and the word was, and I can't prove this, and I don't mean to pile on the guy, but the word was, well, that's never going to happen because Shelley Silver's, who was then he's now convicted, Shelley Silver was the head of the New York State Assembly, and that he was he's a trial lawyer, he works for the trial lawyers, and they're not going to let any reforms go through. And that was just that was considered just a fact of life, just the way it is, and there's just nothing you can do about it. So go someplace else to another state.
That's why we need new thinking, because I'm going there and I'm going to say, you know what? I'll take them on, because not only do we have the scaffold law that the tort lawyers love, we also have. We are the highest medical malpractice in the country. We need tort reform there, too. Do you know a neurosurgeon in New York State starts on minute one with $300,000 of malpractice insurance? You know how much it is in California? $100,000. And you know why? Because they had medical malpractice insurance reform 40 years ago. And you know how they got it? The doctors refused. They stopped working, other than it was a case of life or death. They just said, we're not working. They marched on their capital, and they got it done.
Yeah.
So marching on Albany to get things done. But how does we already have insurance issues in New York. Personally, for me and my family, our medical insurance has been canceled as of the end of the year because Oxford U.S. Healthcare is getting out of that market that our insurance was part of as the end of this year. And every
we
year for the last 3 years.
Yep.
Yeah, they've made us change our doctors every year because they keep changing our network. One of the reasons that it's so expensive in New York, one of the reasons is the malpractice insurance. And that's just another cost certainly for the doctors, and gets thrown right onto the patients. So it's got to end, Bill. Again, I said, I don't know. I hope this data that came out this year, it's a wake-up call again, and if nobody sees it. And we need the business community to rally around. We need them to stand up and to fight like the doctors did in California 40 years ago. They've got to stand up and fight. And I don't feel like enough of them do. They complain, and they get involved in these business organizations. And then they go to Albany, and they talk about, what they want to see happen, and none of it ever happens. So,
Julia,
definition of insane, doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome.
A different outcome. And Julia, I knew you, years ago, I joked with you, you should run for office because you know policy very well. You're very interested in it. And I remember you kind of laughed it off, like, not me. What was it that made you decide to finally say enough is enough and I'm jumping in? I mean, you have a business.
Well,
you have five kids, right? You have five kids.
Yeah, five kids. I've run out of college, two in high school.
Yeah.
I have a very supportive family and a husband that works from home who's incredibly supportive, and I'm so appreciative of that. But I had been following the issues. I started to feel like I understood the issues better than some of the elected officials, and a seat opened on the Rye City Council, and I've now run for that twice and been on that for 4.5 years, continuing to follow the issues at the state and helping candidates run who, on both sides of the aisle, I am a registered Republican, but I've helped Democrats and Republicans. I'm proudest of helping a young woman in Yonkers primary a Democratic incumbent on the County Board of Legislators and win a few years ago. I helped her there. It was her first donation and her first helper, and she's amazing. She's done amazing in the county. I hope she runs for higher office. So I'm bipartisan on that. But when I woke up on January 22nd of 2015 and saw that Shelley Silver, the Speaker of our Assembly, was arrested, I thought, wow, I think there's time, and it's time for change in Albany. And without him there, I think we really can make progress. And that's what spurred me.
And then, of course,
the leader of the Senate the Republican leader of the Senate got arrested a few months later, and they've both been convicted.
Yeah. But how do you? I mean, I'm just going to say what impact Preet Bharara has had in New York. It's just been amazing. Like I said a moment ago, it was assumed that nothing could be done, and people thought for a long time that you know, back channel deals were happening with, I remember with silver was always the rumor, but Barrero went in and proved it.
Well, and by the way, we had a Moreland Commission, which was looking at corruption, started by the governor, and you know what? The governor shut it down, and my opponent voted also to shut it down. So pre-Bahara, you know, enough stuff was picked up during that commission, and he went and kind of took all the information and looked at it, and look what happened.
So, how do you go up there and not let it happen to you? Like, you have people that are very well-intentioned, and they go up to government, and then they end up spending, you know, 30 years there, and, you know, they meant very well, but they get sucked into it. Like, how do you make sure that doesn't happen to Julie Killian?
Well, first of all, I'm term limiting myself. So I'd say the most I would stay there is 12 years. If I can get term limits passed and everybody wants it to be eight's fine. I'll do. But I, you know, I'm an independent person. I don't feel like I have any allegiance except to the hardworking citizens of Westchester and New York State. I'm not a politician. I'm an outsider. I'm a public servant now. I'm unpaid right now. I view myself, as I said earlier, as a citizen legislator. You know, I'm a mom. I have five kids. I just can't imagine myself going up there. And I'll get involved enough in the system to find my allies and get people in a room, because that's what I find works best. People don't agree on something. You get them in a room. You talk about it. You see what the other side is thinking, because very often the side that you don't agree with has some good points, and you get people in a room, and you talk about your issue. You use data, very important. Use data, look at consequences. Don't just do things that sound good. We actually have to do
things
that actually
are good. I'm hearing that Masters of Finance talking.
and look at outcomes. You know, so often it's just the inputs that people look at. Oh, we spent money here. That's great. We have this program. Well, if the outcomes aren't good, then maybe there's something else we need to do. So getting people in a room, finding common ground, and coming up with solutions, and then talking about it. So often in Albany, they don't talk.
Yeah, but you come out of the business world, and, you know, in government, they've never heard of, you know, like zero-based budgeting. I mean, everything, the programs that that exist, if they're not working, they stay forever and they just create a new one.
Yeah, I mean, to me, everybody should start on day one of the year with zero, and then you have to justify every dollar. I hope that whoever becomes president does that. I was hoping Barack Obama, when he was talking about a new way, would have done that. That did not happen, sadly, because I would have just said to all my cabinet people, okay, you have zero. Now you need to justify it all to me. And,
right.
You know, we have a tax cap in New York, except New York City does not. And some people complain about the tax cap, but I'm like, it's just another way to make your school board and your local municipalities accountable. They have to justify every dollar.
Yeah, I'm going
to
do it.
We need more to do.
A tiny pivot. We talked earlier about the Startup New York program and you know, how it's already spent $53 million in advertising for, again, I think it was 409 jobs. It may have been fewer than that. I can't remember the exact number, but it was, I mean, these are insane numbers. You talked about during the summer taking those startup dollars and creating a digital anti-drug campaign, like a drug education campaign. Can you talk to that? I mean, I know it's a little bit off the focus of the show, but I was so interested in it. For, you know, personal reasons, everybody knows people who have had trouble in this area. Sure. What would that look like, and how did you get involved in the drug area? Because I know that's something that you do.
Yeah, I'll tell you quickly about what I'm calling for, and then I'll go back a little bit. I am calling for a statewide digital campaign about the dangers of drugs to our kids, which will get to them right there on their phones, which is where we know they all live. I have teenagers, and I know what they do all the time. And we need to put a little bit more healthy fear in these kids about the dangers of drugs. I started working on the substance abuse issue back in 2011, and I was just seeing kids smoking too much pot, drinking too much, and parents saying things like, I don't know what to do, there's nothing I can do, all the kids are doing it.
There's nothing I can do,
and I just thought there has to be a better way. And, you know, fast forward to right now, I ended up starting a coalition called Rye Action for Children and Teens, which brought our community together. Sadly, 2 years after I started this initiative, we've had six kids die in Rye of drug overdoses. It's heartbreaking, heartbreaking. And what we have done is bring our community together. We have the schools, parents, the police, the clergy, the medical community, the substance abuse community, all our youth-serving organizations are coming together. Last week, we just got federal funding from the Drug Free Communities Grant, and we're getting $125,000 a year for 10 years. I'm so incredibly proud of that. That is actually a federal program that works, by the way. There's enough accountability for us, and we have to report what we're doing, but they don't drown us in paperwork. And we can, and there's an overall Westchester coalition that we work with the other coalitions in what are they doing. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel, but we already have made a difference in our community. One interesting thing about New York is, in New York, like North Carolina, kids are adults at 16. There's only two states that that's the case. So what happens is that when you're 16 and you get pulled in for some kind of drug thing, if it's not something you're actually going to get arrested for, they give you a fine and they send you home. And those kids, you know, kids come up with the money their parents don't even know. So we're working on something, and I hope to bring this statewide, about parents being notified and requiring kids and their parents to go for drug education on the weekends with their parents. And we actually do that with the younger kids under 16, because we can do that. But right now, because the kids are adults at 16, we can't, which is a shame. It's really
I grew up, Julie Killian, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I felt maybe, you know, I was a teenager in the 70s, and I felt like everywhere I looked eventually, probably not at first, there was some message on a school wall or someplace that was saying, you know, this is obviously pre-internet days, that was saying heroin kills or don't be a dope, or there were messages there everywhere. And I wonder if kids today, are getting mixed messages out of government about drugs or no message at all. There seems to be that fear that we had so hardly learned through the heroin epidemic of the 70s, the crack epidemic of the late 80s, seems to have vanished. And kids don't seem as afraid anymore. Do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. One of the biggest things we're fighting against is a perception that the risk level of marijuana is so low. And, you know, the kids see that it's legal in Washington, legal in Washington, D.C., legal in Colorado, and they've heard our president say that he did it, and they just think, well, what's wrong with it? And then, oddly enough, there's parents who also sort of feel like, oh, what's the big deal about smoking a little pot? The thing that people need to know, so when I was a teenager in the 70s, the amount of THC in pot was 0.75. Right now, the pot, if you're only getting pot and something, and if you're not getting something that's laced with other crazy things, it's in the 30 to 40% range. And then when they bake it or cook it with the butane and they make it stronger, it can be up to 80, 90% of THC. And that's what goes in those edibles. That's why those edibles are so scary. When you, like, eat a cookie and they don't feel like anything happens, then they eat another one and people are having psychotic episodes. It's so dangerous. And they have proven that marijuana can rewire your brain. So anybody that was smoking in the 70s, once in a while when it was 0.75, and now their kids are doing it, and they're doing it more, and it's 30% and 40% and more, and they're starting younger.
Yeah,
I worry about the next generation.
Yeah,
I really do.
Teenagers, they say that people with, especially with the one was out in Colorado this summer, and they say that young people, when they take those resins or the different forms of THC now that are 80-90%, you know, people will take it and freak out on it because they can't, it's too strong to them. And then what do they do? Oh, if you're freaking out on the THC, here's a pill to bring you down. There's a Valium or some, you know, something else. And it's easy to get, to, you know, to start crossing into other areas.
Let's talk about business. Marijuana lobby, marijuana, big business. Marijuana lobby has billions of dollars. They are in certain states now trying to push for legalization of marijuana. Now, it was just voted down in Vermont, which I was very happy to see. But they're out there, and we need to be, you know, really careful. I have heard that the governor of Colorado is not happy that he passed that legislation. If he had to do it all over again, he would not pass it. Their numbers for traffic fatalities, calls to poison control, like all kinds of things. If you look at their numbers, where they were, then how they went up when they legalized medical marijuana, now how they've gone up drastically after they legalized marijuana, and the states around them are having trouble too, but they don't get any of the tax revenue from the marijuana, and the social costs are not being covered by whatever revenue they're bringing in. And they sold it in Colorado because they were going to put more money in education, but there was no mechanism to make sure it got to education. So I have a lot of friends in Colorado. My brother lives in Colorado, and they are regretting it out there. I'm sure there's a lot of kids that are not regretting it, but there's a lot of adults and elected officials that are very much regretting that decision. But they're not going back.
And I know that you know many of the parents who have lost children. I do as well where I live. There's just nothing you can do. Can I say one more quick thing, Bill? Please do. Yep.
Just the other thing is they believe the rise of heroin is also related to the legalizing of marijuana, because when the drug cartels down in Mexico were not making the same money off marijuana, they started pushing the heroin and the opiates.
Julie Killian, state senate candidate in Westchester, and looking to bring term limits and other reforms to an Albany in desperate need of them. Thank you so much for being on Mind Your Business. Again, this is Mind Your Business on 77 WABC Radio. I'm Bill O'Reilly of the November team, and I'm guest hosting for Yitzhak Safless, Bottom Line Marketing, your regular genius host, who will be back next week. Yitzhak is off for the holiday. Thank you for listening, and everyone have a terrific night.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Safless, every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.